This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662. Or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today it's a solo effort on my part. Let's call this the Medical and Nutritional Update for October. These are stories that I come across in the news and by reading various medical journals, and we're going to boil them down and discuss the practical import of them for you. So, here goes. Each month, I await with bated breath the arrival of the Premier Nutrition Journal in my mailbox, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It's the definitive nutrition journal in the world, and you know, sometimes there are esoteric articles there that don't have very much practical relevance except for researchers in the field of nutrition. They resolve questions that have little bearing on your actual lifestyle choices, but here are a few that I've culled from this month's edition of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition for October 2016. Which clearly are news that you can use. The first is from an article entitled "High Intake of Regular Fat Cheese Compared with Reduced Fat Cheese Does Not Affect LDL Cholesterol or Risk Markers of the Metabolic Syndrome." This is a randomized controlled trial. Okay, well, so often you see in standard recommendations on diet the suggestion that you follow a low-fat diet, and moreover, you know, even American Heart Association and the powers that be, you go to the CDC website and the websites of various health organizations, and they say make sure that you substitute high-fat cheese with lower-fat dairy versions. Make sure you use skim milk or low-fat types of cheese. So what they did in this study is they compared the intake of high-fat cheese to low-fat cheese versus a third group that just got bread with jam instead. Okay, that was the experimental setup. So it was a regular fat cheese versus reduced fat cheese versus no cheese with the carbohydrate control. In other words, carbohydrate substituted for the cheese in the form of bread with jam. And what they found when they compared the high-fat cheese versus the low-fat cheese is there was no significant difference in HDL cholesterol between the regular fat cheese and the low-fat cheese. When compared with the carbohydrate diet, the diet where instead of cheese you were having virtually no fat, because the bread with jam is no fat, the HDL tended to be higher. There wasn't any difference in terms of insulin, glucose, or triglyceride concentration and waist circumference between the three diets. So it really didn't matter if you substituted low-fat cheese, and things got worse when you got rid of the cheese altogether and substituted it with bread and jam. And so what they conclude is that a high daily intake of regular fat cheese for 12 weeks did not alter LDL cholesterol or risk factors for metabolic syndrome. And clearly LDL cholesterol and metabolic syndrome risk factors are pathways to heart disease. Now, this didn't do this test for years and years and years of people eating cheese or low-fat cheese or jam and bread to see if after 10 or 20 years, more or less people were going to get heart attacks. But certainly from the standpoint of risk factors, there wasn't any difference. And this study squares with epidemiological studies of populations, where they discover things like the Dutch paradox. The Dutch enjoy their high-fat cheese, their cheese connoisseurs, and yet they have a slightly lower risk of cardiovascular disease than their counterparts in other parts of the world that have a lot less high-fat cheese and now are substituting low-fat dairy products. In conclusion, the study results indicate that the consumption of regular fat cheese in high daily amounts, that's like lots of cheese, not just a little bit in moderation, does not affect serum lipid concentrations or fasting glucose and insulin concentrations. These would be indicators of risk for metabolic syndrome, a pathway to heart disease. Doesn't affect blood pressure, doesn't affect waist circumference, make you fatter, does not. Then do reduced fat cheese or carbohydrate-rich foods. And this was done in a population who had risk factors for metabolic syndrome. In other words, they were probably overweight. They had higher waist circumference. Maybe they had slightly elevated glucose, triglycerides, or hemoglobin A1C. And ultimately, the final conclusion, our results suggest that for most individuals, it's reasonable to include regular fat cheese as part of a healthy diet. All right, so more and more studies are exonerating cheese as a potential contributor to heart disease, as is so often stated, and say, maybe it's high time for us to revise our dietary guidelines, because they still call for substitution of skim milk and low-fat cheese for regular high-fat dairy products. And here's another study that has practical import in your day-to-day lives. It's entitled Beneficial Effect of High Energy Intake at Lunch Rather Than Dinner on Weight Loss in Healthy Obese Women in a Weight Loss Program, a Randomized Clinical Trial. Now, it is often said, breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dine like a pauper. That seems to be a recipe for health. Many studies suggest that if you confine the majority of your caloric intake to earlier parts of the day, you'll do better. So a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie. It depends on timing. Timing is everything. And in this study, they demonstrated that. So they did this study as part of a diet clinic intervention at something called the Novin Diet Clinic. It's a private weight loss clinic that uses an integrated approach, dietary, behavioral exercise, and medical treatments to get people to lose weight. They assigned people either having a main meal at dinner or having a main meal at lunch. Subjects were assigned to consume 15% of their energy intakes at breakfast and 15% of their energy intakes with their snacks, with either 50% at lunch and 20% at dinner or vice versa. In other words, 50% at lunch and 20% at dinner, or 20% at lunch and 50% at dinner. They got the same amount of food. And here's what they found. They found that the consumption of higher energy intake at lunch compared with dinner, by the way, the same amount of calories, may result in favorable change in weight loss in overweight and obese women after a weight loss program 12 weeks. The difference in weight loss was, both groups lost weight because this is a diet program, okay? But the group that had a bigger lunch lost on average about a kilo more. That's 2.2 pounds more than the group that had most of their calories at dinner. They say here in the comments section, in the discussion, nutritionists in popular weight loss programs usually advise individuals who are keen to lose weight to have their main meal at lunch. In contrast, many obese people who are trying to lose weight are used to eating a higher energy meal at dinner because of work commitments during the day and believe that they can have their main meal at dinner in a low-energy diet without any deleterious effects on their weight management. Well, according to the recent study, That has practical implications for people following, say, a set calorie diet. You know, you're going to go on a 1,200 calorie diet, have, you know, a couple hundred calories at breakfast, and maybe have 800 calories for lunch, and then, you know, a couple hundred calories at dinner. As hard as it may be to maintain discipline, because when you get home and you're relaxing, you know, that's the time that people often put the feed bag on. And what it has to do with is, well, a variety of factors. You put a lot of calories into your body at a time when you're inactive and you go to sleep. That's a recipe for weight gain. And I often cite the case of sumo wrestlers who are actually training to gain weight. You know, literally, when a sumo wrestler wrestles in the ring, they need a lot of throw weight. And so their regimen is they train pretty hard during the day, and then they're told to just relax and eat a lot of rice, like bowl after bowl after bowl of rice. And they're told, don't do anything after a certain hour. Just have as much rice as you want. Fill yourself up. That's the main carbohydrate calorie source. And then go right to sleep. And that is the diet secret of people desirous of weight gain. So if you want to follow the opposite regimen, eat your meals earlier. Breakfast like a king. Sup like a prince at lunchtime, and dine like a pauper. In this issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the glycemic index takes a hit. Okay, the glycemic index is designed to predict the impact on insulin response of various foods. And this is based on a calculation that is sort of like a calorie bomb, where they analyze how rapidly the carbohydrates in certain foods get released into the body. So, for example, brown rice has a lot of carbohydrate calories, but, you know, a bowl of brown rice that contains 300 calories has a lower glycemic index than a candy bar that has 300 calories, which is full of simple sugars that are released very quickly into the system, hit your body hard, and that's what's called the glycemic index. And they've calculated glycemic index scores for literally hundreds and hundreds of foods, and it's based on the standard, which is 100 for white bread. White bread is actually thought to have a fairly rapid release into the system. And that scores 100, and other things are in relationship to the white bread. So what they discover in this article, it's entitled Estimating the Reliability of Glycemic Index Values and Potential Sources of Methodological and Biological Variability. Translation, everybody's different, and it's different strokes for different folks when it comes to glycemic index. So, you know, it's interesting. There was a doctor named Dr. Philpott, who was popular in the 1960s and 1970s. He's since deceased, but what he popularized is the notion that people should individualize their diets based on their response to certain carbohydrate foods. So there are some people, for example, who eat beets, an ordinarily healthy food that contain carbohydrates, and they get sky-high blood sugars. Other people consuming beets may not have that response, you know, otherwise healthy food. Some people get it when they consume a sweet potato or squash, foods that contain carbohydrates with relatively moderate glycemic indices. They say, the mean GI value for white bread was 62, but the individual variations were about 20 to 25% on that. You know, some of this has an impact on your hemoglobin A1C, on your insulin response, on your tendency to get metabolic syndrome, and therefore glycemic index is gradually getting into disfavor as a means of determining what the healthiest diet is. They say, in summary, our data indicates substantial variability in GI value determinations for white bread, which I erroneously said was 100. I think 100 is the standard for sugar or sucrose, like table sugar. So bread, white bread on that scale is 62. Sugar, I think, is 100. Our data indicates substantial variability in GI values for white bread. And the high degree of variability demonstrates that there is potential to misclassify foods into the three commonly used GI categories, low, medium, and high, which would result in the inability to distinguish between foods, thus invalidating the practical applicability of the GI value. They say that the impact of these findings on GI estimates with chronic disease risk needs to be considered. So it looks like the glycemic index may be biting the dust when it comes to determining the optimal diet. Of course, there's some utility because obviously, you know, when you're consuming carbohydrates, foods at the lowest extreme tend to be better than foods at the highest extreme. But foods that are intermediate, for some people, they're going to be high glycemic, and for some other people, they may be low glycemic. So that's where you might be able to get into trouble. The solution, you know, I hate to say it, is to go on an overall lower carbohydrate diet. There you can't go wrong, because what the glycemic diet index does is it provides you with a supposedly safe rationale for consuming some carbohydrates, some which are considered the good carbohydrates versus the bad carbohydrates. The conclusion that this study invariably leads to is carbohydrates may be more similar in their effects on some people than was once believed. Okay, here's an article that has some impact on the notion that if you eat a lot of protein, it's going to help you build muscle. And, you know, certainly this is a principle that's invoked. And when you go to your local health food store and you find those big vats of protein that are designed to make exercisers turn into, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger with massive bulging muscles, it appears that the sensitivity of the body to protein in terms of muscle support or muscle building is reduced in overweight and obese young adults. So there's just something about the obese state that prevents the protein from going to the muscles to help build muscles. I think that this study, it does not look so much at the exercise effect. It looks simply at the diet effect on muscles. But there's just something about the overweight obese state that interferes with muscle synthesis. And so it looks like it's a kind of a vicious cycle is, you know, once you're overweight, there's a tendency for you to lose lean body mass and possibly accumulate, fat mass, or, excess adiposity in a vicious cycle because of the inhibition of natural muscle building and repair by something in the body that kicks in when you're overweight. So the article is entitled Fat Mass and Muscle Protein Synthesis, and, you know, underscores yet another downside to being overweight. I think this next study will be a very great practical import to many of you out there who are taking vitamin D, particularly those of you who are aggressively supplementing with vitamin D. One of the knocks against vitamin D is that it can help raise your blood calcium. It helps you absorb calcium, which is good. If you want to build bone, that's one of the benefits of vitamin D supplementation. But the worry is that when you raise your blood calcium, you also raise your urinary excretion of calcium. And then what happens is you get calcium oxalate stones. Kidney stones are super painful. And so what is the impact of vitamin D supplementation on the incidence of kidney stones? That's what this study looked at. They say here in the preamble to this article, the safety of vitamin D supplements has been examined in a number of reviews and meta-analyses. The safety of a large single dose of vitamin D was assessed in a recent review that reviewed 30 studies and concluded that large doses, even as high as up to 300,000 international units per day, I don't think it was done for a long time, but maybe in one single dose, you know, maybe that's a dose for, you know, maybe once a month, but that's a huge dose, that large doses do not result in any side effects in healthy elderly populations and can improve the serum vitamin D status. Okay, well, yeah. What about the risk of stones when you do, you know, use high doses of vitamin D, or even just regular supplementation in the higher range? So they looked at a bunch of studies where people got varying doses of vitamin D. Some got as little as 600 or 800 international units per day. That's generally considered pretty safe. But in other studies, they found that people were taking vitamin D 100,000 a week, 9,000 per day, really quite high doses of vitamin D over a period of time. And these are studies sometimes aimed at patients with rheumatoid arthritis, with multiple sclerosis, elderly patients who are at risk for fractures, patients with breast cancer. There really have been quite a few studies looking at the therapeutic effects of vitamin D, whether they work or not. In the conditions that were studied is not the object of the study. The object of the study is to see whether the vitamin D raised the serum calcium or the urinary calcium, and if so, whether that resulted in a higher incidence of stones. And what they found is that high-dose vitamin D indeed raised blood levels of calcium, raised urinary levels of calcium, but surprisingly did not increase the risk of stones. So they write, in conclusion, our results show that vitamin D supplementation results in changes in calcium metabolism with increased risk of high calcium and urinary calcium, but no increase in the risk of reported kidney stones. And so, you know, this is actually one of the long standing knocks against vitamin D. If you take too much vitamin D, it's going to result in, you know, getting kidney stones. But according to the studies, this is very reassuring news for takers of high-dose vitamin D. You know, I still suggest that people exercise caution in taking vitamin D. There was a recent study that I recall where they used really high doses of vitamin D in patients with psoriasis, surprisingly high doses. I think they used 20,000 international units of vitamin D per day in psoriasis. And the way that they controlled to make sure that these patients weren't going to have too high blood calcium is they did not give them calcium supplements, and they put them on calcium restricted diets. So they made sure they didn't have a lot of calcium, thus preventing high blood levels of calcium with such a high dose of vitamin D, and thus preventing the risk of stones. And there was no incidence of high calcium or stones with that regimen. And moreover, it was somewhat effective against the psoriasis. So we can begin to consider high-dose vitamin D as a therapeutic tool in various diseases where there may be D receptors as a target for modulating immunity, or in cancer, or in neurodegenerative disorders where autoimmunity may be a factor. These protocols, from the standpoint of kidney stones, appear to be safer than we once thought, according to this new study that I think has important implications for many of you out there who are dosing kind of high with vitamin D. I still suggest that you get your vitamin D checked from time to time. Don't go way over the top in your levels of vitamin D. It may be unnecessary. And there still be maybe there may be at very high doses the risk of harm.